Thank you, Cheryl. So welcome, anyone listening on the radio or later to the I think we're calling it Teachings from Eastern Wisdom or Truth Teachings from Eastern Wisdom, but we're looking at the Tao Te Ching. Now we've really just started. But before we talk about that, we're just going to have a moment to center ourselves and make an offering of our time together. So just softening the body, whatever that means. And then maybe becoming aware of the breath in order to still the mind. And then from this stillness, finding our way into a expansive place, maybe in the heart center or in the belly. And from here, we're going to make an offering of our time together this evening. May it serve all beings. May whatever we hear, whatever we say, whatever we think be for the benefit of all. May all beings be happy. May all beings be at peace. And taking a deep inhale and exhaling. So, yeah, we looked last week at chapter one, and then this week we're just looking at chapter two. And so, I personally read chapter two every morning. I think I may have missed one morning. Every morning on waking up, just so it was kind of hanging around with me during the daytime. And it did, it really lingered. So I'm just going to read again this chapter two, and then we're going to talk a little bit about it. So I'm going to read Wayne Dyer's translation. He said he took many translations and then kind of just mixed them all together and made his own. And I really like his one for the second verse or second chapter. Under heaven, all can see beauty as beauty only because there is ugliness. All can know good as good only because there is evil. Being and non-being produce each other. The difficult is born in the easy. Long is defined by short, the high by the low, before and after go along with each other. So the sage lives openly with apparent duality and paradoxical unity. The sage can act without effort and teach without words. Nurturing things without possessing them, he works but not for rewards. He competes but not for results. And when the work is done, it is forgotten. That is why it lasts forever. So this is one of my favorite verses, which is funny because it's only the second one. So I'm kind of jumping ahead. But it is one of my favorite because it's such a beautiful reminder of the way we live in duality. So I'm just going to read some of the things I wrote as I contemplated this particular verse. And it brought up a lot of things to me, and a lot of things happened in the week that seemed relevant as well. So I'll share those with you. So this is what I wrote. All can know good as good only because there is evil. There are always two sides to everything, and they make the whole. And yet we judge one as good or beautiful, and one as bad or ugly. Those are judgments, and they aren't real because good, bad are one, like yin yang. They come together. So last week we talked about yin yang and how that beautiful symbol, like the white side of the circle with the dot in and the black side of the circle with the white dot in, how We often think of them as yin or yang, but actually the yin yang symbol is them together. They cannot be separate, they have to come together. And sort of accessing the Tao or being in the flow of the Tao or understanding the Tao has to do with seeing the two as one. Seeing the two both as two, which they are, and we learned about this in verse one. So there are two, there's the white side and the black side. But also being able to see them as one. So it's this idea of seeing duality and then seeing non-duality. And the point is that they cannot exist without each other. You can only have one because of the other, which is what this verse is saying. So as seekers, I wrote, we often push aside jealousy or anger or envy. You know, we think about this dark side and we see them in as in our way. And if people, you know, sometimes they're violent or have views we don't agree with, we think also that they're in our way. I often hear yoga students talking about, oh, this person lowers my vibrations and, you know, this isn't good. And but the Tao really just teaches us, the Tao Te Ching teaches us that they are the same, they're just the other side of the same coin as celebration or peace or joy. So they come together. And another sort of thing we often think about when I know that sometimes when we're early to the spiritual path, there's a lot of talk about manifestation and abundance. And we're taught not to sort of manifest, like not talk about lack. But there is lack only because there is abundance. So if they're together, if you're feeling like you're lacking something, you're really just only seeing one side of what is happening right in front of you. And the Tao Te Ching sort of teaches us to step back and see the two sides as whole and align with the whole. Or at least, if you're not going to align with the whole, align with the other side of what you're wanting. And what happens, of course, when you align with the whole is you don't mind which arises, whether it's lack or abundance, because you understand that they are the same. So it's this beautiful game or a play, a movement that we have of this world of duality where we're shifting between these opposites. And then the Tao Te Ching sort of teaches us to step back and be in a place of seeing them together. And I really love that. And this week I've tried to look at things as just one, and understanding that the words we use seem to separate them. So beauty and ugliness, for example, or good versus bad, those are different for everyone. You know, my perception of good is not another person's perception of good, and vice versa on the bad side. So trying to see aside from everyone else's perceptions, or my own, or even thinking about, you know, perception at all, just trying to see that they cannot exist without each other, and therefore they are the same. Which is sort of mind-blowing to think about, that beauty and ugliness are exactly the same, because of course they are, because they can't exist without each other. They are one. So therefore they're the same. It's just this perception that we've then added on. So it's been a pretty deep week, and one of the things I thought was wanted to share was that I don't know if you know, but we had an annular eclipse yesterday. Didn't have it in the US. It was through parts of South America and parts of Africa. And I work for an astronomy company where I talk about myth and spirituality. And on some of the things I was researching, it was talking about how an eclipse, where the moon covers the sun, is an alchemical marriage, and that it sort of symbolizes the merging from duality into non-duality. So, for example, you know, in our world of duality, sort of talking in line with the Tao Te Ching, we have night or day. The sun is in the sky or the moon is in the sky. They don't come together. And then we have this event in the material world where we are no longer thinking about night or day because night and day come together. So in an eclipse, if you've never been in one, and this year if you live in the US you'll have a chance, because in August there's a total eclipse that crosses America. And what happens is that at the moment the moon starts to cover the sun, the sky obviously gets very dark to the point where you can see stars in the middle of the day, and the birds are very, very confused and they fall silent like it's night. So there is this amazing opportunity and physical experience of like watching this happen, of watching this not night or day, but night and day become one. And I was reading, there's a woman called Dr. Kate Russo, and she's a psychologist, but she's an eclipse chaser. And she's been around the world talking to people about their experiences from watching eclipses. And you know, everyone is moved. And some people say that what happens for them in the middle of eclipse is that they lose their sense of self, that the mind just cannot grasp that there is night, time, and day. I mean, just think, you know, how many years and days of our lives that we've watched this flow of sun and then moon, and then think about our DNA even, and how it's sort of woven into us, and then something this bizarre happens, and the mind can't grasp it, and so in that moment, the mind just sort of steps back and perceives the two as one. So it just kind of blows my mind, because it's like this experience in the material world, which is very rare, unless you're an eclipse chaser, to be able to sort of have that in front of you. So I'm excited about August the 21st, I have to tell you. But I just thought it was this lovely example, and how interesting that people who watch it have this sense of their minds just being blown, and they lose their sense of self, which is really what we're attempting to achieve, by sort of getting our heads around a practice of stepping back from seeing things as a yin or a yang, but seeing them together. So yeah, I just wanted to share that with you. What else did I write here? Yeah, so just continuing with this verse, before and after follow each other. I just love this. I'll just read this little line again. The before and after go along with each other. So what that really is saying to me is that time doesn't exist. And when you think about it, if you're saying that beauty and ugliness, or good and evil, are one, then you're saying past, present, future are all the same as well. They're happening together. For the future to exist, the past has to exist. For the past to exist, the future has to exist. Therefore, they're interdependent and one. They are one. They are happening together, which I think is interesting, because people say if you heal something, you know, from your past in the present moment, if you let go of something, a grudge or something that happened in your past, then you change your future. And that's kind of a similar thing. It's just all one. The time is one, which is again hard to get our heads around. And again, an eclipse is just such a wonderful sort of a physical symbol of that happening, because night and day, what we think of as the passage of time, actually kind of seems to move backwards or stand still at that moment. So the master or the sage, the awakened one, sees the two become one, and so acts without doing, really just lives in the paradox. That's sort of the goal, if you want to say there's a goal, of the Tao, moving into the Tao, that you begin to start to see this paradox in your life of I'm seeing this as good, and therefore there must be something bad on the other side, and therefore that's really just one. And it sort of begins to soften the mind a bit to your judgments. And because of that, the Tao says that the master or the sage then acts without doing. Because of course you would, because things can be left alone. You see something as one, or what needs changing? Nothing. You just leave it alone. So you live in that paradox. And when it goes on to say the sage teaches without standing up and saying a thing, and for the sage, these 10,000 things that we talked about last week arise and then disappear, and she just watches them. Because what else is there to do other than just to watch? There's nothing that needs to be changed. Gina. after this class, and it really jumped out at me that what we're talking about in just different words is acceptance over judgment. When we're talking about living the paradox of not seeing the two but coming into this place of oneness. And I was reading this and it just struck me as having a similar message to this verse of the Tao. This is Galatians chapter 3 from NTI. I ask you not to look at the world and be sad for what it seems to be. I ask you to look at the world and be happy for what it is. See there within the world the light that cannot be extinguished. See there within the world the evidence of love alive. Love your brothers for their truth, watering, therefore, the light that is within them. You are freed of your need to judge as you are freed of your belief in separation. So again, when I think, just another word for what the Tao is talking about here is this idea of separation, that we look upon the world as this or that. And that is essentially looking at the world through the lens of separation. And we're being asked through the Tao Te Ching to come back into seeing it as one. And this is just this exactly the same message that we see here. You're freed of your need to judge as you're freed of your belief in separation. You're freed of your belief in separation as you are willing to water the bush of light with me, it says. Be willing to lay down your judgment with me. I will show you through the guidance of your heart how to seek judgment no more. The message that you hear from my lips is a consistent message. This goes into chapter 4 of Galatians. It is the message of love and freedom, which is where the Tao is, in love and freedom. You can misunderstand my message when you listen through the ears of judgment. You can take my message of freedom and make of it a slave. In this way, my message is lost to you, but I ask you to lay down your judgment and listen to me with clarity. So be still and be in that place of the Tao. So I just love this. It really resonated with me, just an alternative way of thinking about the yin and the yang, and sort of stepping back into this place of seeing the Tao. And what I was thinking about was how I went to a new moon ceremony. It was a gong bath on the weekend, and the gentleman leading it was a very, very powerful shaman. And he was talking about, similar to Tai Chi, you can see darkness coming to you and you sort of just like move it with your hands away and back away. And I thought, well, how interesting that he even sees darkness, because, you know, at some level, what we're saying here with the Tao is that light and darkness are one, and the Tao sort of sits in a place of being unaffected, because you are witnessing them as one, and therefore, you know, it's neutral, there's nothing to do, you've neutralized it. So I'm thinking how this is just maybe another way of just, for some of the shamans, it's taking darkness and then gently moving it back away. It's similar to how we're dealing sort of mentally with seeing darkness and then saying, oh no, that's just the opposite of light and they are one. And in that moment, we're actually sort of diffusing it. But it was sort of an interesting thing for me. But I've sort of been pondering it. Another one of my teachers was pointing out the fact that that when it comes to dark and light, and we talked a bit about this last week, that spiritual seekers, you can get a bit hung up on these words, especially light. But if you're not able to get in a place where you can see the two together, then at least see the positive, at least go for the light instead of the dark. So the way I see it is when you look at the yin yang symbol, you have a choice. So you can see the positive or you can see the negative, or you can see them together as neutral, as one. So of all those three choices, the least desirable is obviously to see the negative, because it will drive you mad. And I'm not saying there's a negative, it's more of a, hi Jay, welcome back. It's more of a sort of personal negative. So, for example, some people are very happy with, and I'm going to just use something that impacts us all, some people are very happy with the presidential pick, and some people are very unhappy. So you can't really say it's a positive or a negative. other than for you personally, because obviously if it's truth, there would only be one side, and there's not. So so we have this positive and negative. So is it better for you to dwell on the negative side of how upset you are about what's happening with the president of the year, if that's where you are? No, obviously it's better, it'll drive you insane and you'll have a miserable life. It's better to dwell on the positive side and try and spin it that way, still being authentic to yourself, of course. But ultimately, what the doubt is, what you're trying to do is not even see the two sides where you want to be, what the goal, again, if you want to use the word goal, would be in the place where you didn't see any positive or negative. You just saw the two as one. You saw it what it just is, just what's happening. So again, to sort of refer to the wording of like Christian texts, it's more like acceptance rather than judgment. But one step towards that acceptance might be just focusing on the positive. So, but there's always a choice. You can see the white side, the black side of the yin yang, or you can see them together as a pattern in their own right. And again, I was just, talking about the eclipse. What was interesting is as you look at an eclipse through special glasses, it's like one of these things your brain can't quite wrap because you. At some point you see like it's the moon going into the sun, and then at other points your mind flips and what you're seeing is a crescent sun, and you don't, your mind is not even seeing that there's a moon in front of it, and you go between these two, and it reminds me of the yin and the yang. You can see the moon in front of the sun if you're looking at eclipse. You can see the black side of the yin and yang symbol, or you can see the white side, or you can see it together as a whole. And of course in eclipse it does come together as a whole. So I found this really helpful in sort of pondering this week about really just like reflecting or even meditating, using as a yantra the yin yang symbol, so you can begin to see that everything is interdependent and everything comes together to create one. It's just our mind sort of tricks us into thinking that one is one light and one is dark, or one is good and one is bad. And I've also been reading Matt Kahn, or have, sorry, rather listening to his audio book, Whatever Arises, love that. And I sort of feel like he has a similar message as to the Tao. Whatever arises, whichever side of the yin yang symbol you're looking at, just love that. And that doesn't mean, oh, love it like, oh, I love yoga and I love hot dogs. It means sort of just be aware of that, like care for that, give it some space. And I feel like this particular verse of the Tao is saying a similar thing. So if your mind starts to do the split into the world of duality, this is positive and this is negative, then just sit there with that and see if you can just be with what arises, which is like taking a step back into the Tao. Okay, what else have I got here? And when you think about that, what you're doing is bringing not knowing to the knowing. So interesting when you write things and then you read them back and you think, I don't know what she meant by that, but you're talking about yourself. But it sounds great. But I think what I'm trying to say is that when you come to a place of just allowing something to happen, just being in acceptance or just the allowing of whatever's arising for you, what you're doing in that moment is bringing this space of not knowing. You're saying, okay, I don't know, I'm just going to watch what arises, to the place of knowing. So what you knew was, I'm unhappy with the way things are, for example, and this is going to end up terribly or something. So that is a place of really strong knowing in your mind. And then you come at it with a place of not knowing, of okay, I'm just going to allow this to arise. And so you're bringing these two sides together, because knowing and not knowing are part of each other, just like being and non-being exist only from each other, which is another interesting thing, because as a and when you're on the spiritual path, you're often aiming for the non-stuff, like the non-thinking, the non-doing, the non-being. But the Tao teaches, no, don't strive for that. They are one. What you're trying to do is really understand that they exist together, and be in the place of allowing that paradox to happen. So a couple of other notes I have put here. How is that even possible? How do we even get to that place of being able to sit back? And what moves us to that boundless place? And that's the kind of practice that we want to cultivate. So it's just worth asking ourselves, like, when am I able to be in that place of just allowing to arise, what's arising? Or, and that could be meditation or focusing on the breath, gardening, which is a lovely way to sort of observe the ebb and flow, prayer and stillness. And even in those, we get to see the opposites, because of course, if we come to a place of sitting in stillness, we're leaving a place of busyness. So we're understanding that stillness and busyness come together. We're only granted stillness because of the busyness. And the other thing I was thinking about, and a teacher of mine was talking about this week, and I had the pleasure of listening to Bruce Ansbach, who's a pastor, and he teaches a lot about prayer. And he was talking about how to come to prayer. And what I thought was so beautiful was that the way he was talking about prayer was that it's a conflict, that there is this way that we come to prayer that is almost from duality. And his point was that you come to prayer with this notion that you are unsafe. So whatever it is you're praying for, you generally have some feeling of, I would like a change in the status quo, normally. Or even if you're praying and your prayer is just, I love you so much, God, that's more aligned with it. But generally, with that comes, I'm needing something, or something's not quite right, or I need to get this off my chest, or something. And he says, and the conflict that arises within prayer is that God doesn't see that. God has no conflict. It's like God is in the Tao. So all God wants is love. That's it. So you come with this lack of safety, and then there's this conflict, because God's just like, oh, just loving you. Just, I don't see I don't see the lack of safety that you perceive. Because how can God see what you perceive, And I thought that was so beautiful, that in that boundless place that we're searching for, how can we get there in prayer? How can we get there in meditation? Because even in meditation, when we come to sit down in meditation, we want something. We're aiming for something. So even in those moments where we're searching to rest in a place to become boundless, and at some point, obviously, it happens within that experience. So of course, we should come to that practice. But how, even in our practice, to become so gentle and so lacking in expectation and demand, that meditation and prayer become just boundless, become a place where the yin yang are together, and we get to be in that just place of oneness, and there is no conflict, there is no duality. I just thought it was a really lovely thing to contemplate as we're sitting down to do these practices. And another thing that arose while he was talking and I was listening was that, there is this subtle cycle always happening, that which is why, the Tao is very connected with nature, and being in nature can really help us be in that place of embracing both sides. So I don't know about you, but I'm getting a bit tired of winter. I've just had enough, and it's not even been a bad winter. This has been a great winter by New York standards, but I'm just kind of ready. But what I was reminded of is that, winter is the time when trees' roots grow. They are really putting down roots in winter, that then allows them in spring to grow branches and leaves, and then blossom, and be beautiful in the summer. So there's always this cycle going on, and obviously one can't exist without the other, and the same as life and death. And we know this, but sometimes we forget to apply it to just every part of our lives, this understanding of the cyclical nature and how opposites are actually part of each other, and neither a good or a bad. They just are. So I thought, something that might help to accompany verse 2. And just, are there more times when you're feeling more accepting than judging? Where are those times, and in what parts of life do you feel you can sit with the opposites, and what are you learning from that, and how can you apply that? This is just some things to ponder. And I just wanted to read what Cheryl just put in the room. She says, I have a beautiful card in front of me that says, what you are praying for is what you already are, which is lovely. And I was reading something today, and it was to do with the Tao, and it was the similar thing. It's like what you're seeking is seeking you. And of course it has to be, because for yin yang to be one, which they are, the one to exist, the other has to exist, and therefore, there's this sort of strange play going on where what you're praying for is what you are. You're just not in the place of the Tao where you can sit back and see it yet. You're still looking at the yin yang, and you're giving more weight to one side than the other. So I don't know if anyone. I'm just going to pause there. Look, that's perfect. Halfway through, I'm just going to pause there and see if anyone wants to share anything of their experiences of moving into a place of oneness before we talk about Wu Wei. Jay's in his car, so he can't talk. Okay, all right then. So I'm just going to read a little bit from Wayne Dyer's discussion on this particular verse. So he says, what if you instead perceived everything as the perfection of oneness? I think this is what Lao Tzu is suggesting with his description of a sage who lives openly with apparent duality and paradoxical unity. I love that, to be able to look at both worlds. Imagine the perfect oneness coexisting in the apparent duality, which we see with an eclipse. Where opposites are simply judgments made by human minds in the world of the 10,000 things. Surely the daffodil doesn't think the daisy is prettier or uglier than is. And the eagle and mouse have no sense of the opposites we call life or death. The trees, flowers, and animals know not of ugliness or beauty. They simply are and are in harmony with the eternal Tao, devoid of judgment. As the sage lives openly with this apparent duality, synthesizes the origin with the manifestation without forming an opinion about it. So really he's living without judgment, living in perfect oneness and acceptance. And maybe even more than acceptance, it's just sort of an awareness, and acceptance implies there might be something you wouldn't accept. He invites our wisdom, the sage, to combine the perceived opposites and live a unified life. The perfection of the Tao is allowing apparent duality while seeing the unity that is reality. Life and death are identical. Virtue and sin are judgments, needing both to identify each other. These are the paradoxes of a unified life. This is living with the eternal Tao. Once the dichotomies or pairs of opposites are transcended, or at least seen for what they are, they flow in and out of life like the tides. I love that. Practice being a living, breathing paradox every moment of your life. And I was thinking about this as thinking about birth. And actually Wayne Dyer talks about this in his with Oprah Winfrey. And if you haven't seen that still, it's on my playlist on YouTube. There's a lovely couple of interviews he does with Oprah Winfrey about his life is with a year with the Tao. And he talks about how the baby is, you're not doing anything for a baby to grow, and the baby isn't doing anything as it grows within you. And each of us have been in that position in our lives, obviously, where we have not been doing, but we have been growing, and growing from a little nothing to a full-on something baby. And we didn't do a thing. And I think that's such a beautiful thing to think about with the Tao. We're always pushing, we're always wanting to do something to grow, especially when we're on the path. We're like, I'm not growing fast enough, I'm not having enough realizations, I must do. But then we think, well, actually, this moment of this 9 months, we were being created and being born, and we did nothing during that period. So I always think that's a lovely thing to remind ourselves when we start to push too hard. And this is where we get to Wu Wei. So Wu Wei is one of the pillars of Taoism. And it literally means, well, it's normally Wei, Wu Wei. And it means in Wei, Wu Wei, doing, non-doing. But Wu Wei is what people generally talk about. And I'm told it's pronounced Wu Wei. it means non-forcing. So I just wanted to read you something about what this is. This effortless effort, actually, is as Ashanti might call it. And this is from Salala Taula. So Uwei is one of the most difficult concepts in Taoist philosophy. Roughly translated, it means doing nothing or not doing. And Westerners who are first introduced to Taoism think it means sitting around doing nothing, a passive acceptance of life and a sort of mushy, hopeless attitude. But nothing could be further from the truth. Alan Watts calls Wu Wei a form of intelligence, that is, of knowing the principles, structures, and trends of human and natural affairs so well that one uses the least amount of energy in dealing with them. So, Alan Watts, and I've got a couple of his audios on the YouTube playlist too. He talks about Wu Wei in this way of rowing would not be Wu Wei, but sailing would. So if you've ever gone sailing, you're just having to follow where the wind is and then tack your boat accordingly. Rowing, of course, there's a lot of force and pressure, and actually Alan Watts talks about Wu Wei as being non-force. So far from being an attitude of passive acceptance or resignation, says Salala Taula, it is instead an active engagement with things as they are. It's a way of working with the dynamics of any situation in order to find the path of least resistance and then following through. You can also think of, in terms of martial arts, I'm not particularly familiar with them, but where you have a force coming at you and your what you learn, I'm assuming, is how to sort of move with that fist as it comes at you. And so then sort of move around it and then and sort of move the energy back at the other person. That would be an example of Wu Wei instead of boxing, perhaps. So the true meaning of Wu Wei is something like not doing anything against the flow, or not doing anything that does not have its roots in the Tao. And he goes on to say it can also be think of as not overdoing. So that's the idea of not forcing. Lao Tzu gives us this advice: overfilling a vessel is not as good as stopping before it is filled, obviously. Oversharpen a blade and it will lose its edge. Oversharpen a pencil and you've lost it. Pile up golden jade and it will be impossible to guard it. Going after ranks and titles in an arrogant and haughty way, you will bring about your own downfall. Withdraw when the work is done. This is the way of the Tao. So Wu Wei is the opposite of Yu Wei, action without you action, sorry, with useless efforts. And it's coupled with this spontaneity and deep awareness of what's happening in any situation. And we know that when you think of like the spontaneity or the naturalness or the ease of Wu Wei, you might look at athletes who are just in the zone, completely in the flow. Musicians, perhaps, when they just, they hit their stride, seem to channel something from above or below. It is the perception of the currents of any situation and our place in it. Wu Wei can only be learned by becoming more and more sensitive to both our own internal rhythms and those of others. And that's really what it comes down to with the Tao Te Ching is teaching just be still, because how can you truly listen and be in tune with what is happening so that you can just very naturally move around it or with it like water. So a dam would be the opposite of wu-wei, for example. What you want to do, and this is talked about a lot in the Tao Te Ching, is become like water, so that we can just sort of flow through things and around things. And he talks about Tai Chi, which is a practice for the physical practice of Taoism, being an example of Wu Wei. There's very gentle movements that move with the energy and with the body. And the more you practice Tai Chi, actually, the more you get a sense of that you're not even doing the movements. They just sort of become this rhythm that you take part in. So Wu Wei as an attitude is an attitude and approach to life itself. When we become sensitive to the current of change around us, then we can make intelligent decisions at all times and use the innate wisdom of our bodies and energy systems as well as our minds. It's learning not to it's learning how to conserve our energy and not to spend it frivolously or in fear or confusion. I thought that was a lovely sort of short summary of Wu Wei. We're going to be talking about it a lot over the course of the next 70 or so weeks as we look at the Tao Te Ching, because it comes up and up and up and up. So it's really this going with nature. And I thought, you know, we can think about Wu Wei, you know, when we come to our meditation. That is my oven. When we come to meditation, as it's sort of, or prayer, as it's a reminder of not pushing and not forcing, but just sort of this non-doing. And next week, we're going to listen to a couple of audios about that. But as I say, we're going to talk about it at length later because it sort of ties in with chapter three, which we'll be looking at this week. So I thought what I might do is play an audio. It's Dalala Towler, and he tells this really lovely story that gives not only a real feeling about the difference between Confucians and the Taoists, but it has, it's a really great example of Wu Wei. It's quite long, and it's an audio, it's 8 minutes. So I'm gonna play it, which gives me the perfect chance to go and take my stuff out of the oven, which unfortunately took far longer than it was supposed to, so I'm sorry to interrupt that here. So, okay, so here is Dalala Towler's story about Wu Wei, and then we'll regather afterwards.
This is a little story that explains the principle of Wu Wei, and it's called the Way of Wu Wei. Once upon a time, in the land of the Middle Kingdom, there lived a great emperor. This mighty lord lived in a magnificent castle, surrounded by many guards, ladies-in-waiting, cooks, artists, philosophers, and doctors. He awoke each day to the soft caresses of one of his many wives, ate his breakfast in a wonderful garden surrounded by the morning song of his many birds, and passed his days in the company of his many admirers and flatterers. But he was not happy. He felt that he was missing out on some essential thing of life. Just what this essential thing was, he did not know, but he knew that he did not have it, and this distressed him endlessly. He filled his court with various magicians and philosophers, all of whom tried to tell him that if he would only listen to them and them alone, he would find this essential and missing ingredient of his life. But he knew that each was only trying to better his own individual situation, and so did not heed their shining and flattering words. Instead, he winnowed them out, one by one, until there were only two groups left, the Confucians and the Taoists. But he could not decide which of them had the secret and essential thing that he was lacking. The Confucians were a haughty yet wise lot. They did not flatter him in silken phrases like the other philosophers had. They told him where his character was lacking, and how he only had to reinstate the old rituals and he would be fine. They told him of the mighty days of old, where the emperor was truly the son of heaven and could rule in heaven's name. All he had to do was return to those old days and revive the ancient ways of the old rites and rituals, and his kingdom would prosper. He would be happy and fulfilled, both as a ruler and a man. The Taoists, on the other hand, seemed an unorganized and motley crew. They never seemed to agree on anything, even among themselves, and spent their days performing strange movements like animals in the garden, their nights drinking wine, reciting poetry, and trying to seduce his ladies-in-waiting. But they were said to have great powers over the elements and the secret of eternal life. Of course, when he questioned them about this, they only shrugged and said, "We have but one precious secret, and one only, my lord." "Well then," he would say, "what is this precious thing?" "Ah," they would counter, "we cannot describe this secret in words, great and powerful lord. We can only show it to you." "Agreed," said the emperor, and announced a contest between the Confucians and the Taoists. Whichever could show him the true secret of their power, he said, would become the supreme teachers of the land. On the appointed day, the Confucians and the Taoists were led to a great chamber deep in the heart of the castle. A great curtain was drawn down the center of the room, dividing the Taoists from the Confucians. Both groups were told that they were to create a painting, a great work of art, on the wall on either side. This would be the final test of their power and knowledge. Whoever impressed the emperor the most would be awarded the prize. The Confucian smiled and quickly ordered all the colors that were available in the royal storerooms. They immediately went to work designing and painting a magnificent mural. The Taoists, on the other hand, ordered a great deal of wine and a few dozen soft cloths, the softest that were available. Then they went to work on opening the wine. Day after day, the Confucians labored on their huge and wondrous mural. Day after day, the Taoists ordered more wine and simply rubbed the wall with their soft cloths over and over while singing old drinking songs at the top of their lungs. Finally came the day when the emperor would view each work of art and make his decision. First, he visited the Confucian side of the room, certain that he would be in for a visual treat. He had watched how assiduously the Confucians had applied their layers of colors in the wall, and how they stopped often to study the ancient texts and perform slow and stately rituals before taking up their brushes again. He was not disappointed. The Confucians had created a marvel of color and form. He saw his whole city laid out before him, with his own castle in the very center of the city, the golden light of the setting sun glinting off its shapely and graceful roofs. At the edge of the painting he saw his own magnificent form, astride his favorite war horse, leading his victorious troops into battle against an already vanquished enemy. A great river ran across the bottom of the painting, with cunning little waves painted all over it, and the curly shadows of birds suspended above it. It was truly a wondrous and amazing sight, and the emperor was at a loss as to how the Taoist could top it. Imagine his surprise that when he crossed over to the other side of the room to view the Taoist work, only to find a completely blank wall and a lot of slightly tipsy Taoists doing their strained cloud-like movements. True, the wall was very shiny and smooth after numerous applications with the soft cloths, but there was nothing there, no paintings of his magnificence, no golden palace, no wondrous river. "What is this?" he thundered. "You did not even try to paint a picture. Is this the way you curry my favor?" "Oh, but we have done our best," cried the Taoist indignantly and a little rudely. "But there is nothing there," said the emperor. "Is this truly how you view me? Is this your precious secret?" "Wait one moment, please," said the oldest and tipsy of the Taoists, his long beard still damp with wine. "Please draw aside the curtain between our walls, and then you will truly see our work." So, shaking his head in wonder, the emperor had the curtain drawn, revealing the dazzling painting of the Confucians. The emperor stood before it once again, marveling at its wonder, and how they seemed to get his noble brow just so. Then, his mind already made up as to who was the winner this day, he turned once again to the Taoist blank wall, only to find there, not a blank wall after all, but the reflection of the painting on the opposite wall. Only this time, instead of a flat and static picture, he saw, reflected in the unbelievably smooth and shiny wall, a moving picture. Somehow, because of the play of light on the shiny surface there, it seemed as though the painting had come alive. There was the palace and the town again, only he thought he could detect movement behind its windows. The river itself moved, the waves lapping against each other and the birds pirouetted overhead. And lastly, he could see himself there, astride his great stallion, whose very nostrils seemed to quiver in the air, while his own beard fluttered in the breeze, and his lips seemed to move with his own shouted orders to his troops. He was amazed. He was astounded. He turned to the tipsy Taoists and asked them with humility and wonder in his voice just how they had managed this miracle. The Taoists seemed to hang their heads just a little and answered simply, "It is actually in not doing that we have achieved this wondrous thing, sire. All we did was create the space for the painting to happen and let it paint itself." "Is this then your precious secret?" asked the great lord. "Yes," answered the Taoist, "it is indeed. We call it Wu Wei, or not doing. And it is in creative and natural not doing that we are able to achieve the highest level possible." Then they turned and bowed in unison to the dumbfounded Confucians. "We congratulate you, noble sirs, in your great work of art. We watched you every day work so diligently while we drank wine and rubbed the blank wall. What you have created is truly marvelous. But with your industry, you have only created a flat and lifeless thing, while we, in our formlessness, have created a living world." It was said that afterwards, for the length of his reign, the emperor gave the Taoists in his kingdom his royal ear, and they taught him many things until the day came for him to ascend to the heavens on the back of a dragon to take his place in the realm of the immortals.
I just love that story. There's so many things I love about it, how the Taoists are just like, pretty chilled out dudes, drinking, sipping on wine, rubbing on the wall. But I think it's just such a lovely example of Wu Wei and this idea of that you create so much more by this not doing. You create space for something to be born into. So I just wanted to read another small thing before we depart. And this is the way of Chuang Tzu. I gather it's Chuang Tzu, like it's Lao Tzu, but the Lao Tzu, who was another amazing teacher and has a book called his name. And there's a translation by Thomas Merton, with a preface by the Dalai Lama, and it's very beautiful. And it talks about all these lovely stories that Chuang Tzu shared. And he's a bit more colourful than Lao Tzu, because the Tao Te Ching can be a bit dry, but these stories from Chuang Tzu have the same teachings, but a bit more colourful. There's one thing he says, and I just wanted to share it. He says, "I cannot tell if the world considers happiness, what the world considers happiness is happiness or not. All I know is that when I consider the way they go about attaining it, I see them carried away headlong, grim and obsessed in the general onrush of the human herd, unable to stop themselves or change direction. All the while they claim to be just on the point of attaining happiness. For my part, I cannot accept their standards, whether of happiness or unhappiness. I ask myself if, after all, their concept of happiness has any meaning. My opinion is that you never find great happiness until you stop looking for it. My greatest happiness consists precisely in doing nothing, whatever that is calculated to attain happiness. And this, in the minds of most people, is the worst possible course. I will hold to the saying that perfect joy is to be without joy. Perfect praise is to be without praise. If you ask what ought to be done and what ought not to be done on earth in order to produce happiness, I answer that these questions do not have an answer. There is no way of determining such things. Yet at the same time, if I cease striving for happiness, the right and the wrong at once become apparent all by themselves. Contentment and well-being at once become possible the moment you cease to act with them in view. And if you practice Wu Wei, you will have both happiness and well-being. Here is how I sum it up. Heaven does nothing. Its non-doing is its serenity. Earth does nothing. Its non-doing is its rest. From the union of these two non-doings, all actions proceed. All things are made. How vast, how invisible this coming to be. All things come from nowhere. How vast, how invisible. No way to explain it. All beings in their perfection are born of non-doing. Hence it is said, heaven and earth do nothing, yet there is nothing they do not do. Where is the man who can attain to this non-doing? Just beautiful. So with that, I'll leave you in chapter 3. You can find online if you want to read it over the week, and we're going to talk about that next week. So I recommend just reading it at the beginning of the day. They're really short, and chapter 3 is very short, and it just sort of sits like a seed for the rest of the day to ponder on. And that's it. I don't know if anyone has any questions. Otherwise, I'm going to play a song just to lead us out. And so next week, we'll talk a little bit more about Wu Wei and go into a bit more depth and probably listen to Alan Watts' comments on Wu Wei, which of course very wise. Okay. So blessed week, one and all. I look forward to seeing you next week or in the room up during the week. And with that, I'll leave you with Alexi Murdoch.
Grace of God be with you always in your heart. May you know the truth inside you from the start. May you find the strength to know you are right, part of something beautiful. May the grace of God be with you always in your heart. May you know the truth inside you from the start. May you find the strength to know you are right, part of something beautiful. May the grace of God be with you always in your heart. May you know the truth inside you from the start. May you find the strength to know you are part of something beautiful. May the grace of God be with you always in your heart. May you know the truth inside you from the start. May you find the strength to know you are a part of something beautiful. And I thought that I saw the light shine. I thought I saw a light shine. Yes, I thought that I saw a light shine. I think I see a light shine now. May the grace of God be with you always in your heart. May you know the truth inside from the start. May you find the strength to know you are part of something beautiful. May the grace of God be with you always in your heart. May you know the truth inside from the start. May you find the strength to know you are a part of something beautiful. And I thought that I saw the light shine. I thought I saw a light shine. Yes, I thought that I saw the light shine. I thought I saw a light shine. Yes, I thought that I saw a light shine. I thought I saw a light shine. Yes, I thought that I saw a light shine. I think I see a light shine. From the corner of my eye, thought I saw a light shine. From the corner of my eye, thought I saw a light shine. From the corner of my eye, thought I saw a light shine. From the corner of my eye, thought I saw a light shine. From the corner of my eye, thought I saw a light shine.